I'd like to call this meeting of the House State Affairs Committee to order. The time is 3:18 on Thursday, February 26, 2026. We're here in room 120. Please remember to mute cell phones today. Members present are Representative St. Clair, Representative McCabe, Representative Vance, Representative Holland, Representative Hemshute, and myself, Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Our record secretary is Cecilia Miller. And our moderator from the Juno LAO is not Renzo, but is Jude Augustine. Am I right? Ah, good. I got it. And our committee aide for today's hearing is my staff, Stuart Relay. We have two items on today's agenda. We'll first take up House Joint Resolution 23, the constitutional amendment on a governor's balanced budget from Representative Underwood, and then we will turn to continued committee discussion on House Bill 152 from Representative Galvin. So first on our agenda, I'd like to welcome Representative Underwood back to our committee. This is our third hearing on this resolution today. On Tuesday, I set an amendment deadline for Wednesday, February 25th at 5 p.m., which was yesterday. We received no amendments. Is there any final discussion on HJR 23? Seeing and hearing none, Representative Underwood, did you have any closing comments today?
Thank you, Chair Carrick. And committee members, I just want to say thank you for giving me the time to present this and for your really good questions. Help prepare me for the next committee of referrals. So thank you for your time and appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you for bringing this forward. At this time, I'll look for a motion. Representative Hemshute.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the House State Affairs Committee move HJR 23, also known as 34-LS0747-A, with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
And seeing and hearing no objection, House Joint Resolution 23 has been moved from committee. We're going to take an Addies to sign the paperwork and prepare for the next presentation. I'll also note for the record that Vice Chair Story has just joined us. Addies. House State Affairs is back on the record, and at this time we're going to turn back to House Bill 152, Establishing an Education Head Tax, from Representative Galvin. This is our fourth hearing on this bill, so today the intention is to continue discussion on the legislation, and we will be setting an amendment deadline today at the end of this discussion. I'll note that we have Connor Bell online from Legislative Finance, who's available for questions, and that we only have until 4:15 today. So with that, I'm going to turn it to Representative Galvin to do a brief presentation, it sounds like, we have on the legislation, and members can feel free to flag me for questions as we go forward. Thank you for joining us again.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. I know some of you are pretty familiar with this bill, and I thought what it might be helpful for me to do, since today is amendment deadline, is to share with you, first of all, a very brief overview, and then let you in on how and why I chose the levers that I have, what levers there are, so that you might be thoughtful of different things you could do with this bill, if should you want to, and depending on what you want to achieve, there are all sorts of options with regards to turning this into the revenue bill that you want to turn it into. So as you're well aware, this is an income tax bill. It proposes, first of all, there's also a head tax on it. So every single wage earner in Alaska will be paying $150 as a head tax. And then also there's for anyone who earns more than $150,000, the dollars above $150,000 will then be taxable at 4%. And our intention is for joint filers for the home, it would be $300,000, anything above that threshold. And then it also closes the current S-Corp loophole. The reason is that as an owner of a corporation, if it's an S-Corp, they do not pay taxes because we have no income taxes in the state of Alaska. And this would close that loophole. This also, as you know, captures the incomes of high earner non-resident workers. Again, that's only high earning non-resident workers would be paying the 4%. This can function as a component of the sustainable fiscal plan that I know many of us have spoken about, and how we would like to eventually reach an opportunity where we don't see Alaska's revenue stream so unpredictable. This is one option as a broad-based stabilizer. So in terms of how we got to where we are, there are so many options when it comes to models. And I want to go through some of that. We could have chosen you've heard already about a state sales tax, for example. Lots of different things that can happen with this tax. And I wanted you to know that the reason that income was chosen is that it's pretty well known among all economists that income tax is an opportunity to ensure that those who are already in poverty are not experiencing a tax that is more burdensome. So if you, or someone who's living with in rural Alaska, for example, with higher priced items that would be taxed, they would be experiencing more of the burden than in urban Alaska, for example, where there are lower taxes. So lots of options also, even on the income part. People make incomes in many different ways. And I think I'm going to pass this now over to David, who can get us into more of the particulars of why we got here. And we're going to quickly move through these few slides and then open. And then I'm happy to hear whatever the chair would like to do with regard to a conversation.
Through the chair to members of the committee, this is David Jang, staff to Rep. Elise Galvin. Just briefly about this graph right here, so as well as the contents of the slide. So it illustrates the full range of income types that could be included in this income tax. And this is every proposal should decide on what these categories to include. And as you can see with this graph, most of the personal income in the state comes from salaries and wages.
And my goal was to make this very simple, simple to implement especially. So we went ahead and chose a way for us to implement a tax system that would allow us to use the federal tax forms that we are already have in place, all of us as wage-earning Alaskans. And so that's how we got to choosing this. And David can explain further. Again, this is Elise Galvin for the record.
To the chair, this is David Jang. This slide here shows the options available for determining a final income figure on which the state tax would be calculated. There are three main options, and the starting point would be with the federal system that we have currently. First would be to use a federal adjusted, first option we would have would be to use federal adjusted gross income, or AGI, which is the total taxable income minus certain adjustments, such as contributions to retirement or health savings account contributions. The second would be to use federal taxable income, which is this AGI, adjusted gross income, minus either standard or itemized deduction. And the third option that you see here on the slide is tying the state tax directly to the amount of federal tax that is owed.
So we tried to choose what we thought was the most simple. And this is Elise Galvin for the record. And, you know, our options truly are, how high do you want to tax and where do you want to have your exemptions? And with that, David will further explain where we ended up.
In this, in House Bill 152, it was selected to have federal adjusted gross income with certain adjustments as the income that is taxed. So that would be option one from the previous slide. And this proposal will include a standard deduction of $150,000 for single filers and $300,000 for joint filers. Which earnings above those amounts, as we mentioned previously, the 4% flat tax would be applied. And that would be saying yes to that standard deduction. And we did have a flat tax rate of 4%, and we did opt for a head tax of $150.
And I'd like to note that we do know there needs to be an amendment made, certainly because of the 150-150. So if you're in a dual filing home, currently the way the bill is written, it's not acknowledging that it should be a joint $300,000 flat floor, I should say, for that to start. So that is something that we expect to change throughout the process, if that's the intent of the committee, of course. So, you know, in essence, we want you to know that, of course, this is every lever will determine where we end up in terms of revenue. So, and that's on this process, on the committee to look through this and make decisions based on what goal they want to accomplish. For us, we felt like the minimum amount of 150 was a fair amount considering what it costs to live in Alaska. We didn't want to take food off the table. But if we drop that to 75 or 150 per household, it would bring in a significantly different amount of revenue. And I wanted to make sure that you all saw that. So if you wanted to bring in $610 million, and honestly, I think that number is based on old data that we had. So that was before PICA, before Willow, and so likely this number may be adjusted quite a lot. But I wanted you to know that we're looking at more than $500 million if you chose to change that lever, for example. And then the other levers that could be changed would be, you know, what do we want to do with regard to the head tax? That could change as well. This amount we felt, again, was fair, and we would be able to pay for all of the fiscal notes, for example. That's important to us that we can handle a new tax division. And so anyhow, this gets you a visual for what that would look like if you were to change it. Again, it may not be absolutely up-to-date data, but it gives you more or less where we are. And then I think, is that the last slide we have? So that gives you a sense of some of the different levers, depending on how much revenue you think the state needs to bring in and the way you would like to do it. And of course, more importantly, what your constituents, whatever you believe that your constituents would be able to support. And I'm happy to answer any questions or help to be here to think through the implementation of this.
I think we do have questions. So thank you for the opening presentation, Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hello, Representative Galloway. I got a bunch of questions. Why is this labeled as an education tax?
It's labeled as an education tax because one of the deepest holes we have in our and deepest spends in our budget is education and health. I wanted the public to know that we acknowledge that. And of course, it's just intent language. You can never force the next legislature to do something with money. We've had these before. We've had lots of opportunities where we might tell what the intent is of the next legislature, but it cannot be enforced. Good question.
I understand because I looked that up. I'm sorry, follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you. And you asked what my constituents want. They don't want a tax. Let me go on to the next one. How many other S-Corps are there, through the chair, how many other S-Corps are there in the state other than Hillcorp?
Oh, there are a lot of them. Thank you for that question. I don't have a number because that's not something that I was able to get from the Department of Revenue. It's possible that they know, but I do not have that number. But there are a significant number.
Follow up. If we could get that information, that would be great. And then last question, when we were going with a percentage of federal tax returns, what if someone gets a refund?
So this would be just for income tax that they're writing. So I'm not sure. Can you describe maybe more what that scenario would look like?
Through the chair, I think that it actually, now that I think about it, isn't really relevant because you don't use deductions, et cetera. And you made a comment about dual income $300 head tax. Let's say if my wife and I together, do each of us pay the head tax or is it $150 total?
If you each make a wage, you would each put in $150.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll go to Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you, through the chair. I think the first thing I want to ask about is we saw the ICER report that came out a month ago, I believe. And I know that report talked about a couple different income tax approaches. And I haven't pulled it back out again. It may be something for us to follow up on, but I'm curious if you have any comments about how ICER had kind of characterized different options on income taxes. And if we go back and pull up that report, is there anything you recall about the two different income tax types that they described, how this one would fit into those options on there? So if I go back and look at that report, I'll know which one to look at.
I believe that they showed one that was a tiered progressive income tax. So that means they had various tiers, multi-tiers, maybe at $50,000 a certain rate and $75,000 another rate, something like that. They had it with far more tiers. I have a floor of only one tier there, so that might be a significant difference. I do not know if they had modeled the high earner tax at anything similar to what this is, Representative, through the chair. But I do know that they were also using data that was from 2023, again, not representing the major projects that we know are happening on the North Slope, wherein the average wage is more than $175,000. And in fact, from those in industry, I'm hearing the wage is even higher than what I'm hearing from ICER. So I don't have exact details on that, but I think it's important to note that what I hear from industry is at least 50% of the workers are from out of state. So we are currently not capturing, you know, anything from there. And that's another thing that I think many of you don't know yet, that most of those workers coming up are being taxed in their home state. And they're being taxed at more than 4%. And we're not going to double tax them. That's against the law. They would be, though, giving that 4% to Alaska instead of their home in Idaho or wherever they live. And so essentially, the way I look at it is that we are leaving those dollars on the table. It's rough because it will mean that we're going to be taxing Alaskans. You can't just tax out-of-staters, and that's rough. And I get that, but I wanted to make sure that we were evaluating our options. That's why I put this on the table for us.
Follow-up? Great, thanks. In terms of the implementation of this, have you given some thought to how we might turn this on? Right now, I think we'll probably need to at least change the effectivity date on this. And I've been pondering whether or not, given the fact that most people of any income stature are struggling to pay bills these days. So if we make a change, they've got to accommodate that. And I've been pondering, would it make sense to have maybe a multi-year, turn on the head tax 1 year, turn on part of the income tax the next year, something to help people move into this? Any thoughts or approaches that you've had in terms of how to approach turning this on?
So I understand what you're thinking, that, that there are kind of two different pieces here. The head tax, which is a bit more simple in a way, mm-hmm. because the way that the Department of Labor has described it, they can take it off the first paycheck. Little bit of complication. There would have to be an affidavit or something if you have multiple jobs, right? Because then you'll have to say, actually, this is my first paycheck of this year. Don't take it off my second job, the first paycheck of the second job sort of thing. But that is... my understanding, that lever is a bit more simple. There's also ways to pay, though, the 4% for the high earners. That could, the way we have it presently, it is Department of Revenue working with the PFD so that you could be paying for it through your PFD. That is a little bit more complicated. So that next level may be a little more complicated, but I can tell you, if you don't get it put into law soon, we're looking at probably 2 years before we're going to see revenue from it. So that's something to keep in mind, is all of these things take time to build up. I think that was a very good question and thought about how to step it in. And, again, this is up to the pleasure of your committee and what you want to do with the bill. And I'm worried about making sure education gets taken care of. So I'm looking at whatever revenue measures we can make.
One more follow-up, and then we're going to move to the next question.
Yeah, great. Thank you. And it was the permanent fund connection that you just brought up that was my last area I wanted to explore briefly. It's been proposed in a couple different places that maybe there would be a netting of permanent fund to tax liability. And it's been proposed in some ICER documents that perhaps there'd be a way to do this on a pre-tax type of basis so that we'd be reducing the amount of money from our permanent fund that's flowing to the federal government by way of income taxes on that income. And I'm curious if you've learned any more about how we might be able to allow people the option to have their permanent fund amount available as a credit, but in a way that it would not become taxable income on a federal return.
Yeah, thank you for that question. The second part is the part I don't know. And that's probably the key part you're looking for answers. So we will contact again the Department of Revenue and see if we can get an answer for that one. But can we can we make a lever? And I think they've already looked into the cost of the IT to do that. Can we use permanent fund to pay our taxes? Yes. The answer is yes. But your question of, well, then will that then make it so that you no longer have to pay your federal taxes on that PFD? I don't have an answer to that. It would be nice. I know that once there was an energy extra check that came our way in, I think, 2007-ish or 2000, maybe it was closer to 2001, there was an extra check that went to all of the PFD recipients that was called an energy check. And that one we did not have to pay federal taxes on. And I don't have the answer as to why. So that would be something we would need to understand.
Great. Thank you.
We'll go now to Representative McCabe.
Thanks. Representative Galvin, so you've called this an education tax many, many times. And I've had this argument so many times in the 6 years I've been here. But Article 9, Section 7 of the Alaska Constitution clearly, clearly prohibits dedicated funds except for the permanent fund. If this bill explicitly states that nothing in this section creates a dedicated fund, then how can it publicly be marketed by you and others as education funding when we know it's really just legislator funding? It can go, we can spend it wherever we want.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. And I think we've had that question through Representative St. Clair as well, the very same question. And as I said before, legally, we can only put intent language. We cannot make any next legislature spend money in a certain way. That is, I think you were referring to the proper statute. That is absolutely correct. And where do we spend most of our money? It's either in healthcare or in public education. And we know we have a very deep hole right now, and I thought it was important that we fill it. And so that's why you're hearing this called. That is my intent. I'll tell you that.
Follow-up.
That is my intent.
Follow-up. I'm going to give it to you, but I also just want to note that last year, this committee added language designating, again, you can't dedicate, but we designated some of the marijuana funds revenue that currently goes to UGF through an amendment Representative Vance brought towards public education fund. And so what's happening in this legislation is similar. So I just wanted to note that like this committee has taken up very similar language before. But the point is taken. Go ahead and do the follow-up.
Sure, yeah, and we wrestle with this question all the time, dedicated versus designated, and parsing words. And there's a couple other pieces of legislation, frankly, that do the same thing. So, but you mentioned it a minute ago. Your projections show non-residents would only contribute 15 to 25% of total revenue, and 75 to 85 percent would be paid by Alaska residents. So, at one point, I heard this was primarily a measure to tax out-of-state North Slope workers, or at least that it was targeting is the wrong word, but attempting to get them pay into our education, even though they don't really normally have any kids in our school system. So I wanted to get the 75 to 85% primarily paid by Alaska residents on the record, but does that seem fair that we would tax, in this education tax, out-of-state workers that don't use our education system?
So now we're saying it's okay to call it education tax. I hear you, Representative McCabe. That's fun. And I'm going to tell you this. So the bottom line is they're paying taxes in their state. They're getting our good jobs. I want more Alaskans to get these high-paying jobs. I really do, but they're not. And they're making their money off of our resources. These are Alaskan resources. I want the opportunity for every child to get those jobs. And you know how they're going to get those jobs? is if we have a strong public education system. So it kind of goes around. I mean, we can argue about this all day long. And the number 75 to 85% is not, I don't know the accurate number. I appreciate that you brought that one up. That's based on old data. I think that it might be higher than that just because of the fact that we have so many more projects going on, new projects. And if we get in the pipeline, the gas pipeline, it's going to be 10,000 workers. And they've said likely 50% of those workers will be from out of state. So yes, you're right. It's a lot of money that we're capturing from out of state workers. I don't want to lose it. That said, I'm not making this bill happen so that we can just get their money. That is not the only point of this bill. But a lot of Alaskans have been saying for years and years that it's not right that so many non-Alaskans are coming up and getting the highest wage jobs. So I bring it up because I think it's important that Alaskans know how this tax bill has been designed.
Follow up.
We'll do one more follow-up, and then we're going to keep going around.
Thanks. Yeah, so Trans Magazine, I think in January, said 25% of the workers in Alaska, not necessarily on the North Slope, but in Alaska, are out-of-state workers. And that's driven more by the fact that we can't find workers in-state, not by companies that are going out-of-state. But there's also many of Alaska workers that work out of state or even out of country. In fact, some of the miners, the hard rock miners, are working in Australia. But I'm curious about the reciprocity agreements for, you say that you can't be double taxed, you can't be taxed on income that you earn in Alaska and also be taxed on the same income in Oregon, say. But there needs to be an agreement, right, between the state and between the two states and how you're going to do that and how Alaska is going to do that. There's some sort of a reciprocity agreement that you can work out with the states. And I didn't really see, and I didn't really get that far into the bill, but I didn't see any kind of establishment of any kind of reciprocity with other states in there.
Yeah, thank you for that question. It's pretty, this is normal. There are a lot of workers who work in other states. And so the way the tax forms are written is there's a line where you say where you're paying taxes elsewhere. So then that gets removed from your tax due for that state. It's as simple really as that. And there are times when it can be complicated if you work in many places or you have many businesses. I appreciate that if you have many S-Corps. So that can get to where, but by and large, this bill isn't written to complicate matters. Like I said, roughly 75% of Alaskans will be seeing that 150 off of their paycheck, and it's maybe 25% of Alaskans who will have to take the line item from their federal tax form. And when we talk about, I think you mentioned 25 from the Trends magazine. So here's the unique thing about that. We have a lot of people coming in who are low wage earners. And so the out-of-state low wage earners would not be affected in this way, because we're really only, if you would have to make $150,000 or more. And so I do want to comment that I'm not sure what the percentages of dollars, if that makes sense, are earned from out-of-state workers. That piece I haven't yet, we don't have new data on.
Thank you. Vice Chair Story is next. And I just want to note, we have about 20 minutes left today, and I've got a lot of folks in the queue, so I'm just going to let each person who hasn't yet asked a question try to have a chance to do so, just so folks are aware.
Thank you, Chair Carrick, through the chair to Rep. Galvin. Thank you for your presentation, both of you. And just a quick comment and then my question. I've had several people remind me that they paid an education tax way back when, $10, I believe the tax was. And so that was just interesting to me that we had a tax designated for that, and everyone felt felt good about that going to the education system. But my question has to do about the closing the S-Corp loophole. We've talked about that a little bit. Could you explain how this bill
works for closing the S-Corp loophole.
Sure. I'll have my staffer address that.
Through the chair to Representative Story. This is David Jang for the record. Currently, Alaska does not have state income tax, only has corporate income tax. In the case of an S-Corp, that person, one person, is the corporation. And as it is currently, they're not taxed under this system. This one, if you were to, as we're doing here, implementing a state income tax, then that would capture individuals as well as the proprietors of S corporations.
So if you own a company, you are oftentimes they will file under S corp so that they don't have to pay corporate tax in Alaska. And if you are a single owner of a company, and there that state has an individual income tax, which this is, then you now have to pay tax. Simple as that. So anyone in this case who's making above 150, the way we've written it, they will be subject to the tax. And they are considered in this case as an individual, and they will have to tax. They will have to pay the tax.
Follow up.
Yes, so they pay federal taxes right now, and then they would be paying state taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
You bet.
Great. I had put myself in the queue, and then I have Representative Vance and then Himshute. But do you know what the average income tax is across the country? And then I'm just trying to also compare this legislation with some of our Western states, which have more similar population demographics to Alaska.
Thank you for that question. I, in my very first presentation, do you have that, the page for that? I think that we do have that information for you, Representative. I can tell you that by and large, it is much less here. I think our message, our take-home message is that we're not going to lose any workers. There was always some concern that if we bring in a tax, an income tax, then everybody's going to run out of state. A lot of people moved here because there are no taxes. In fact, we get paid to live here. So we did some research on that, and I'm going to have my staffer, David Chang, reply to that. Thank you, Chair.
To the chair, this is David Chang for the record. I don't have the exact average of the tax rate across the country, though I can say that there are the vast majority of states have some form of a state income tax, and there are only seven, I believe, states that don't have a state income tax, with Alaska being one of them. And there, so that's what I can say about across the country in terms of state income tax rates.
So. And thank you. This, for the record, this is Elise Galvin, and we will be sure to get to you our data on that, which we do have, but it doesn't seem to be before us. But I do know, I recall, here we go. So Alaska is 5.8% in combined state and local taxes, so that's just overall. And then the next lowest one, we're at the bottom, the next lowest one, and this is data that's it's 2021, so not absolutely accurate, but the next one would be Wyoming and Tennessee, which are at 7%. So we are more than 1.2% less than the average, than the other two below us. But I can tell you that in general, they're looking at, so New Jersey, 11.7, Delaware, 10.3, we get a lot of folks up from Idaho, 9.6, Montana, 10.1.
So, Representative Galvin, are those numbers you're reading just income tax, or is that just overall tax burden?
It's overall tax burden.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks.
So just to follow up on that, and it's okay that we don't have the information available right now. I know it's stuff we can find, but I have a couple of questions I'd like to, have follow up on. One is the average income tax rate overall. Secondly is being able to compare the income tax rate in a few of our Western states, so like Washington, Oregon, Idaho, et cetera, Wyoming. The overall tax rate is sometimes a little bit harder to compare, and I appreciate that you have that information, but that's, I want to break that down into the income tax rate. Mm-hmm. And then also, if any of those Western states have either a provision similar to what's in this legislation or another way that they dedicate revenue towards education, I'd be really curious to know that too. So those are three questions that I have. And then a fourth question is, and maybe you do know the answer here, is there another state that this legislation is maybe closest to emulating? And if you don't know, don't worry about it.
Thank you, Chair. I will mention that your number three, which was related to how other states are dedicating, I think it's important that we note that our state constitution is pretty clear. So for us, I think we would have to have a constitutional change, which is a pretty far stretch. I think for now, intentional language in general has worked. Mostly if we can meet that, I've seen that our state does a pretty good job, although, of course, emergencies come up and we don't have to. But with the income, with the marijuana tax and other things, we have found that if the tax does bring in revenue, the intent language does help guide to some degree. But I do appreciate that it's not mandatory. So just for the record, I want to make sure that you appreciated that that question may be trickier to accomplish since they have other, different constitutions than and our state.
Just to be clear, the question isn't what is Alaska able to do, because I do recognize that and understand that. I'm curious what other states do in terms of, particularly Western states, in terms of do they have similar prohibitions? Do they have a way that they're dedicating through an income tax revenue towards education, designating or dedicating? So just curious to see how we compare.
Thank you. We'll do some research and get back with you with your committee. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to go to Representative Vance and then Himshoot. Those will be our last two questions.
Okay. Thank you. I have a whole litany of questions. I have technical questions, but I want to build off of the questions from the chair. You know, we're talking about looking at income tax in other areas, but excuse me, have you considered the cost of living and the accumulation of our tax structure? Like on the Kenai Peninsula, my district has a 24% higher cost of living than Anchorage, and that was pre-COVID numbers. And then and I'm still in the road system. Our spendable money that we have left out of the paycheck as Alaskans, I think, is much smaller than a lot of these other Western states. And was wondering if you considered that. And the other part of that, and I apologize if I've asked it previously, is how did you come to the conclusion of the $150 head tax and the $150,000 threshold? So those are kind of all in the same vein of a question.
Okay, thank you. And I do appreciate what we heard from Vice Chair Story that years ago, and that was in the 80s, we were at $10 for a head tax. They weren't really quite in the same hole that we're in now, but it was an effort made to help Alaskans come together and collectively to pitch in. So is $150 the magic number that seems fair, especially if you're living in poverty? That's up to this committee to decide. Does that number make sense? Did we look at every single district? I mean, look at Bethel, which is, I think, 16.2% tax of their local taxes, for example, and their costs are extraordinarily high, mm-hmm. and there aren't very many jobs there. So I appreciate your concerns, and I also know that if we don't fill this huge gap, we're going to be our state's going to be spiraling down. We are now really reaching that spot, so it's up to all of us to be reaching into this conversation and thinking through what you know, what threshold makes sense is $150,000. So what, again, I'm going to reiterate this. That means that your constituents would not be paying any of that 4% until they were making over 150. And then if they were making over 150, let's say they made 151,000, they only pay 4% of that $1,000. So I just want to make sure we understand that. That's $40. We're not asking them to pay for all of the any taxes on all the dollars below that. Can one person live on 150 or maybe a family 300,000? I'm not going to answer that for your district. I don't know. But it felt like an okay space for us to be when we were making those decisions. But you may change that. You guys might change it to 100 or 300. It might be, you know, just a completely different number based on what you think is best. I'm laying this out as where I thought it would be fair and not take food off the table. That's what I was trying not to do. But you may have a different answer in that. And I respect you.
Follow up?
Quick follow-up, and I apologize for our time constraints.
No, I just just trying to understand the basis of where you got these numbers. Mm-hmm. And then on your presentations, you showed the estimate of what that would bring in, but then you stated that those were old numbers. How old are those numbers, and are you able to get new estimates for us? Because it's hard to make the decisions on any changes if we don't know what the
appreciate
revenue
that.
Would be.
Yeah, very, very good question. And we've put the ask in to the Department of Revenue, and we've not received answers. I hope we get answers so that we can give them to you as soon as possible. I do think that would be helpful. And I think my staffer may have something to comment on. Thank you.
Through the chair to Representative Vance, this is David Jang for the record. As to your question on how do we arrive to those, I want to speak about the historical context of the head tax. And I did a little bit of digging and looked at the head taxes that were applied. I can actually send this as a follow-up to the committee on exactly what was implemented until the tax was taken out in 1980. And put that amount into a CPI inflation calculator. And back then, around, let's say, like 1950, don't quote me on the exact year, and all the way through, like the amount of the head tax ranged from $90 to $115. That being said, in the bill, it's $150. That number is not set in stone, but I think this historical context gives the committee an idea of what the historical value of this head tax is.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I do appreciate that we also need to have an understanding of what revenue would be captured if we, let's say, if you choose to change your lever to 100, make your floor of the wages at $100,000 instead of $150,000, that could be drastically different because we know there are a lot of wage earners between $100,000 and $150,000. So we will try again to get that number because we think we know based on old models that there were a lot of Alaskans within that range, and so we'll try to get those numbers to you as soon as we can.
Thank you.
Final question. I apologize. It will have to be relatively brief. Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you, through the chair. First, I just want to say it takes some courage to file a bill like this, and whether we like it or not, it's an important conversation. So thank you for that. And then my question had to do with, I used Google and it said that $10 in 1980 is $40 today. So the 150 is quite a bit more than that. But our standard of living has changed also in those 46 years. So so my question was mostly about how you calculated the 150, like how you arrived at that number.
Thank you, Representative Hemshoot. And I think I've discussed it a little bit with Representative Vance. It was, how do we get to a number that I wanted to pay for this new whole new division, really. I mean, who wants this? Nobody wants a tax division. Of course not. But we need to do the responsible thing for our state to deliver services. And so I wanted to make sure we had an opportunity for every Alaskan to pitch in. Every Alaskan now is going to say, I'm holding my state representative accountable because I am paying taxes, right? We all joke about how we all complain that my tax money is going to this. Well, not everybody's paying taxes. This is a small head tax that is paying for services that we believe in and that's constitutionally our duty. And so the question was what number makes sense? And I was trying to make sure we captured enough revenue to cover at least the expenses of making this happen. And then the other layer would be what would capture the revenue that I think truly would help shore up our major problem that we have in terms of revenue. We were very, very fortunate up until now to be able to live off of almost entirely oil and gas revenue, or oil and gas combined with the corpus of the PFD earnings being so strong for Alaska. And now we're living in different times, and sadly, we need to now look at then how can each of us pay in if we're wage earners. And it's a tough number to come up with, and I'm open for you all to wrestle with this along with me, because it's not an easy problem to solve.
That's good. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that's a good place to leave it off. Thank you, Representative Galvin, for bringing this forward. I just want to echo Representative Himschut's comments that it is a very important conversation to have, and it's a hard bill to introduce because for as many of us that have some constituents that would support something like this, we all have constituents who have a lot of hesitation and desire not to pay taxes through this kind of tax. And so I appreciate you being willing to sponsor this and have the conversation with us. We are going to set House Bill 152 aside. I would like to ask the sponsor to please try to get answers to some of the questions asked at the committee today in writing to our committee, just because it is my desire to move this bill forward. And I think there are a lot of really good substantive questions that were asked today. And so if you could do that, that would be fantastic. We are setting an amendment deadline for House Bill 152 for next Friday, March 6th. So that's 8 days from now at 5 p.m. So next Friday, March 6th at 5 p.m. And I, again, would like to have the sponsor submit some written responses. We also do have this bill scheduled for next Thursday. And so we will have, I'm hoping, one further opportunity before doing amendments to speak with the sponsor and likely in response to some of those questions. Thank you, Representative Galvin and staff. And that concludes House State Affairs for today. Our next meeting is not at our usual time or location. Our next hearing is a joint hearing with the House Judiciary Committee on Monday, March 2nd at 1 p.m. in Davis, Room 106. And all this information will also be sent to your offices. This meeting will take place during the Standing Judiciary Committee meeting. So please note both of the time and location changes. And it will discuss voter data sharing with the Division of Elections and the Department of Law. I would note we will still have our two usually scheduled Tuesday and Thursday hearings next week. And we do have full agendas for both of those hearings. And we will be done doing subcommittee as well. So we'll be granted back our committee time. With no further business before House State Affairs, we are adjourned at 4:12 p.m.